Well, it is tough today to finish this series. I really have gotten so kind of emotionally attached to the series. Every series I do, I get emotionally attached, and it feels hard to say goodbye to a series because you've lived with it for 6 weeks, and now you've got to say goodbye. But I've enjoyed going through Song of Solomon so much, just chapter by chapter, verse by verse, that we're going to start another book study in 2 weeks, and we're going to go through the book of Daniel. We're going to talk, how do you stay godly in an ungodly world? When the culture around us is becoming more and more secular and more ungodly, and it's becoming harder and harder in America to stand for Christian values. What do we do and how do we make a stand? And so we're going to be teaching through the book of Daniel next. The first half of the book is very historical. The second half is very prophetic. We're going to be talking about the question, is Jesus going to come back in our lifetime? A lot of people want to know, is he going to come back in our lifetime? We're going to be looking at that in the book of Daniel and talking about that. But today we're going to finish our series on Song of Solomon. We're going to finally find out who this chorus of friends are that have spoken throughout the book that reveals their identity in chapter 8 today as we study it. First off, let's look at our foundation text, chapter 1, verses 1 through 3. Solomon's Song of Songs. Again, Solomon wrote 1,005 songs. This was the greatest song out of all the songs he wrote. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is more delightful than wine. Pleasing is the fragrance of your perfumes. And again, that's our goal from our church with this series, is that we would become a pleasing fragrance to the people around us, that the world would look at our marriages, the community, the people around us would look at us and they would say, how do you do that? How do you have so much love, so much passion? Where do you become people like that? You are a pleasing fragrance to the people around you because you're living by God's standard and God's ways. Your name is perfume poured out. No wonder the maidens love you. What we've done the last 6 weeks is I have really been aggressive about challenging the world's way of doing things. We wonder why there's a divorce rate in the church that equals the divorce rate in the world. It's because we as Christians in the Church of America, by and large, have bought into doing things the world's way. So it's no wonder we're getting the world's results when we're doing it the world's way, when God has given us a standard for dating, for marriage, for sex, for relationships. And if we would live by God's standards, and those standards aren't to punish us, they're not to penalize us, they're not to take away our fun, they're to protect us and bless us. Because if you do it God's way, then you have lasting relationships and you have lasting fruit and lasting pleasure. And life is just so much better when you do it God's way. And so we're challenging the world's way. And I've never honestly felt the weight of pastoring like I have the last 6 weeks. As I begin to look a lot of this is brand new to me as I began to study it and really see how much God has to say about this stuff. It has really burdened me as I look at the state of Christianity in America and realize how far we are away from God's standard. As believers, not just the world, but as believers, how far we are away from God's standard. And I've been so burdened to just help you, as Romans says, do not be conformed to the way the world does it, but buy into God's way, because God's way works. And a lot of people avoid this book because it's a tough book. I mean, there's a lot of symbolism. There's a lot of metaphors. If you don't really understand the culture, the Hebrew culture, this book doesn't make a whole lot of sense. You heard us last week. We talked about, you know, he says your belly is a mound of wheat, and men, no woman ever wants to hear you use the word mound in regards to her belly. Yet Solomon said that, but when you understand the Hebrew culture, it was actually a very beautiful thing that he said. So what I did is I took a shot at translating this. This is the modern Aaron translation. I took some verses out of chapter 4. And so look at this with me in chapter 4, verse 1. How beautiful you are, my darling. How your eyes behind your veil are illuminated like a 60-inch LED Samsung television. You get that, don't you? That makes sense to you. Verse 2, your hair is like gravy flowing down off a mountain of Cracker Barrel biscuits. That's for those of you from the South. Your teeth are like Titleist Pro V1 straight out of a new sleeve. There is nothing better. Each one is a twin. None of them stand alone. See, you understand it like this, don't you? Your lips are like the scarlet fenders of a Ford Mustang. Your mouth is lovely. Your temples behind your veil are like a pomegranate smoothie fresh from Jamba Juice. Your neck is like hole 16 at the Phoenix Open. On the bleachers hang the banners of 1,000 sponsors, all of them warriors. Your breasts are like two glazed donuts from Lucadia Donuts, perfectly frosted and available Sunday mornings before service begins. Until the day breaks and the shadows flee, I will go to the mountain of Chanel perfume and to the hills of Febreze. See, that helps to make a little sense, doesn't it? You can laugh in church. The Bible says laughter is good medicine. Week one, we began with the art of attraction. We talked about what do we need to do to be attractive to the opposite sex? What should we look for as single people and somebody from the opposite sex? And in marriage particularly, what do we need to do to remain attractive? A lot of times you get married and then you just take your foot off the gas. You need to stay attractive to your spouse in marriage. And we're not talking about physical beauty there. Week two, we talked about the world's way of dating versus God's way of courting. And the theme was, you play like you practice. We wonder why we have a divorce rate in the church. You play like you practice. And what dating is practice for divorce. I like you, I like you, I don't like you. I like you, I like you, I don't like you. We're teaching people that when I'm done with you, you are disposable. Week three has been the most downloaded sermon we've ever done in our church. That was chapter four, the honeymoon night, 16 verses on sex. We titled it Great Sex. And I've never been more nervous in all of my life to just get through a Sunday. But the theme that week was you cannot have a godly marriage without a passionate sex life. And you cannot sustain a passionate sex life without a godly marriage. They go hand in hand. And if you want to know what God's standard for sex is, read chapter four, because it's passionate, it's amazing, and it lasts a lifetime. You'll see today that they're in their 60s and 70s, silver-haired senior years, and they're still going at it today like they were on their honeymoon night. And that's God's standard. The devil wants you to have sex before you're married and to stop having sex after you're married. God wants the opposite. He wants you to protect yourself before you're married so that it's passionate, beautiful, and it lasts after you're married. Then we talked about how to fight right. You're going to fight in marriage. Conflict can actually bring you closer together if you make some pre-fight decisions. Last week was about their love begins to deepen. And today we're going to talk about the most important word in any relationship, and that's the word commitment. And this is a word that we don't like today. And I'm glad we're doing it on Father's Day, because men of integrity, men of honor, really understand what this word means, what commitment is all about. Because we live in a culture today that doesn't want to commit to anything. I mean, we build outs for everything, every contract, every deal, every business arrangement. We build an out for it. And yes, there are certain business deals and arrangements where you need to have a contract in place and you need an out, but that should not be in marriage. You know, we've invented something in the world today called no-fault divorce, where you can just walk away when you want to walk away. And that will never work in a godly relationship, in a godly marriage. You have to understand commitment. And the thing about commitment is you only need commitment when it's not working out. When everything's going good, you don't need commitment because you're enjoying it. You're having fun. You like it. But when things fall apart, that's when you really learn how to commit to something. And I'm not naive today. I know there are many people here today who've made mistakes. There's many people today on their second and third and even fourth marriages. What I'm simply saying is you may be on your 32nd marriage, but let's just make sure there's not a 33. Let's just make sure that you start today living by these principles. Forget about yesterday. Remember the rules. God will wipe out yesterday. He will cover yesterday. His grace is sufficient. He will cleanse all unrighteousness. Satan right now wants to come in and just tell you you are worthless. He wants to fill you with guilt and condemnation about your past. And if you're going to get through this message, you're going to have to block that message of guilt and understand it's not about yesterday. It's about from here on forward. And what commitment really means is being willing to be unhappy for a while till you learn how to work it out. That's what commitment is. You learn to be unhappy till you learn to work it out. In marriage, we say it like this in the wedding ceremony, till death do us part. You know, we all love that phrase in a marriage, but none of us really want to be tied to it. And let me explain something about the wedding ceremony. When you do vows in a wedding, you're not doing vows to each other. When that minister asks you, do you take this woman to be your lawful wedded wife for rich or for poor, in good times and bad times, in sickness and in health, till death do you part? You're not saying I do to her. You're saying I do to God through the minister. That is a covenant you are making to God, not a human being. It's the deepest level of covenant and commitment. You are making a promise to God. God, 30 years from now, I'm putting it in my diary, I will be at this woman's side 30 years from now. I am committing to you, God, that I will be loving, that I will be committed in this relationship in good times and bad times and sickness and health and for richer or for poor. And I know some of you are looking at me right now thinking, come on, man, it's 2013, Pastor. That's just not the way it works anymore. Divorce is normal. It's common. It's just something you do. I'm challenging you today. That is not normal. It is not God's way. We like to say in the wedding ceremony, what God has joined together, don't let anyone figure out a way out of. And that is the truth. And I know there's pushback. I felt it all 6 weeks. You're hearing stuff that is totally radical to you because so many of us have bought into the world's way of doing things. And I feel it. And I can just sense you saying right now, you're asking too much. I mean, you really understand what you're asking of us. You really understand the level of commitment you're talking about. Just stay with me to the end of the message, because I'm not only going to tell you how you can do this, but I'm going to give you the secret and the power to actually make this a possibility. Let's start off in verse 5 of chapter 8. Here's the friends talking. They say to this couple, who is this coming up from the desert leaning on her lover? They don't recognize them anymore. They're basically, what they're saying is, you're not the same people from chapter 3 when you got married. You're different. You've grown. You've matured. There's a love. There's a passion. It's who are you? And this is my goal for each of you, that no matter where your marriage is right now, whether it's holding on by threads or whether you have a great marriage, that a couple years down the road, if you will just buy into God's principles, that we will look at you and say, who are you? You don't even look the same anymore. I mean, you guys have a joy and a passion in life about you. We've never seen, but who are you? That's our goal. She goes on to say, beloved, under the apple tree, I rouse you. The apple tree is a symbol of passion in the Bible. There your mother conceived you. There she who was in labor gave you birth. Now, she's not saying mom was there on the apple tree. What she's saying is God created me for you and you for me. God had a plan in this thing. God brought us together. We did it God's way. He brought us together and he had a plan. And she goes on to say, place me like a seal over your heart. Now, a seal in this day and age, in this culture, it was like a signet ring or a medallion. You would press it into hot clay or hot wax, and it would guarantee an agreement or a business arrangement. They would seal it, and it would give you ownership that I am guaranteed. It's like a credit card. You swipe it, and that's what the seal was, saying, this is now mine. I own this thing. I possess this thing, this business deal. I'm putting my stamp, my seal on it. And she's saying, I want to be a seal on your heart. She's saying, I want to be owned by you. I want you to possess me, to own me. I want to be completely yours, and I want you to be completely mine. And she goes on to say, like a seal on your arm. Now, the arm is the symbol of your livelihood. It's your strength. It's your work. It's your career. It's your hobby. She's saying, listen, I want to be more important than your career. I want to be more important than your hobbies. I want to be more important than your job. I want to be a seal on your arm. I want to be the most important thing in your life. And then she says, for love is as strong as death. And this is exactly where we get the line in our wedding ceremony, till death do us part. For love is as strong as death. It's jealousy unyielding as the grave. This word grave in the Hebrew is the Hebrew word sheol. It literally translated is hell. Its jealousy is unyielding as hell. It burns like blazing fire, like a mighty flame. What she's saying is only death can separate us. Because if I break this agreement, if I break this commitment, if I break this covenant, let me burn in hell if I ever break this commitment. That's literally what she's saying. That's serious commitment here. This is a serious covenant she is making to her wedding. And this is God's standard for commitment, covenant, and marriage. Let me burn in hell if I ever break. You know, in a wedding ceremony today, we say the words, I do. Literally, if you wanted to do it biblically, you would say, do you take this woman to be your wife, sickness and health, richer or poor, till death do you part? Like hell I do. That's literally how we should say it. But that wouldn't sound as nice as I do. So we say, I do. But that's literally what she's saying. When you study these Hebrew culture weddings, what they would do during the ceremony is they would take an animal, they would sacrifice an animal, a lamb, a sheep, a goat. They would cut it up into pieces. They would take the bloody pieces of this animal, spread it on the ground, and the bride and groom would walk through the bloody pieces of this animal, and they would say to the crowd around them, let this be to us if we ever break this commitment. Let this be to us. I mean, this is powerful what God is talking here. And the first point I want to say is lasting love is possessive. Lasting love is possessive. I belong to you. You belong to me. I have a friend that was counseling a couple in their church, and The woman in the relationship, she made a mistake. She was unfaithful, terrible mistake. It was a one-time thing, just a terrible thing. And she was repentant. She wanted to restore the relationship, but the guy was just done. He was just done. He didn't want anything to do with it. He was out the door. He was done. And they did everything they could to help bring this couple back together, but he couldn't do it. He was done. And on his way out the door, he looked at my friend. He said, "Pastor, do you have anything in the church for drug addicts?" And my friend said, "Well, what do you mean, drug addicts?" He said, "Well, my brother, he's a drug addict. He's been in and out of rehab, in and out of jail. He has stolen money from us. He's broken our trust. We've given him chance after chance after chance. He has just been totally, you know, just every chance he's got, he's taken advantage of us and stolen from us." And my friend looks at him. He says, "Wait a second. You mean to tell me this brother of yours who has been unfaithful to you his entire life, who's taken advantage of you, broken trust, everything else, you're willing to give him another chance, and this woman made one mistake and you're willing to throw her away?" And he looks at my buddy and said, "Well, Pastor, he's blood. And I'm here today to tell you the only difference is your definition. Because what covenant says is you are closer to me than blood. When I enter into marriage with you, when we perform that wedding ceremony, we are making a covenant and a commitment that we are now closer than blood." Now, I have a son, and obviously, if he ever ran away to sin, it's hard to imagine at 5 years old, but if he ever ran away to a life of sin and drugs and homelessness and whatever else, I would literally chase him to the end of the earth to find him, to restore him, to bring him home, to take him back. I would do anything for him. And most of you are sitting out there saying, "Yeah, I agree with you. I would do the same thing." But isn't it interesting how we redefine the marriage relationship? Isn't it interesting how we look at the marriage relationship different than we look at the relationship with our children? We go to the ends of the earth for our children, but we don't quite look at marriage the same way. And I'm telling you, it is the same. It needs to be brought back to blood level relationship, possessiveness. I can't divorce you. I can kill you, but I can't divorce you. And I know I can feel the pushback already. I can feel it. But just listen to me. God's way works. Just follow me. Again, you know, if you're on the 33rd marriage, let's just make sure you don't get to 34. Let's just make sure from here on out, forget about what you did yesterday. Because those of you who are on second and third marriages are feeling pretty bad right now. Stop the guilt. Stop the condemnation. That is not from God. His grace is covering you right now. Apply this to today. Because I know people on their second and third marriages and even fourth marriages who have allowed the grace of God to come in. And they have the most beautiful, incredible marriages, even better than many people on their first marriages, because they're applying these principles and they're starting fresh today. So start fresh today. Let's move on. Verse 7. Many waters cannot quench love. Rivers cannot wash it away. She's saying there's no circumstance that can stop this love. There's no circumstance. He's saying no circumstance can stop my love for you. Goes on. If one were to give all of the wealth of his house for love, it would be utterly scorned. What he's saying, if you tried to buy love, it would never work. If you came to me and said, "Listen, I will give you $10,000 for Amanda," I would probably slap you and tell you you're an idiot. You're just no way. You're dumb. Just don't even go there. If you came to me and said, "I'll give you $10 million for Amanda," I would say, "Let me pray to the end of the..." No, I'm just kidding. I would be more angry. Why? Because you're telling me my love is quantitative. You're telling me that you can buy my love. There's a price on my love. And I'm telling you, there's not another woman. There's not another job, not fame, not nothing can take the place of my love. Lasting love is persevering. Lasting love is persevering. And married people, help me out right now. There's a lot of single people here today that they think that they're just living in a fantasy land. I mean, they're just thinking if they find that perfect right person, that it's going to be walking in the tulips and midnight strolls on the beach and everything's going to be wonderful. Help me out, married people. Love is tough. I mean, marriage is hard work. You got to make some tough decisions to stick it out. And I promise those people who get divorced today don't have worse problems than people that stay married. They're not willing to pay the price. And I know there are some extreme situations out there, you know, where people need to get out of some dangerous, violent situations. But we're talking about, by and large, 50% of the divorces in America are over convenience, not out of, you know, the 1% who's being beaten up and threatened in physical violence. We're talking about the majority of divorces in America are over convenience. And what I want to do is help you redefine a convenient relationship to a covenant relationship. And let me tell you what the difference is. A covenant relationship surrenders rights and assumes responsibilities. See, if you want to be in covenant, you got to surrender your rights. It's not about my rights, and you got to take on responsibility. A convenient relationship protects rights and shirks responsibilities. You've heard me say it all throughout this series. The grass is not greener on the other side. And if the grass is greener on the other side, the water bill is going to be higher. I'll tell you the truth. The grass is greener where you water the grass, where you put the effort in. And the feeling of love will follow the action of love. Let's get into this third point. We're finally going to figure out who this chorus of friends are in verse 8 and 9. Here's the chorus of friends. They speak up. We have a young sister. It was her brothers. Remember in chapter 1, she was angry at her brothers because they made her work in the field. And she was blaming them because she's now the ugly girl. She's dark skinned. She's not attractive because they forced her outside in the fields working hard. It was her brothers, and their brothers all along were this chorus of friends. We have a young sister and her breasts are not yet grown. What shall we do for our sister for the day she is spoken for? Now, I want every man in the building that has a daughter to write this verse down, to circle it, to remember it, to do something. This is an incredible verse for you to share with your daughter one day. What shall we do for our sister for the day she is spoken for? How do we know when you're ready? How do we know when it's time? How do we know you're right for marriage? How do we know? Here's the answer. If she is a wall, if she protected herself, her purity, her virginity, if she is a wall, we will build towers of silver on her. We're going to lavish her with blessing and with gifts. But if she is a door, one translation says a revolving door, a girl who is promiscuous, just one guy after another, just a revolving door, we will enclose her with panels of cedar because she's not yet ready. She's not yet ready. Before I do any wedding here, I ask some very tough questions of the couple. And I sit him down and I say, listen, are you sleeping together? And they're not expecting to hear that from me, but I'm not gonna bless that wedding if I don't get a commitment to purity. And we'll delay it, we'll move it back, we'll do whatever it takes. And I've learned lessons. I've made mistakes in weddings I've done in the past. I'm not doing it anymore. I'm not gonna give my blessing as a minister on something if they're not gonna do it God's way. And so I ask them, are you sleeping together? And if they are, I challenge them to make a commitment of purity until the day they get married. And the reality is the majority of the weddings we perform in the world today are couples who have slept together. And what we do is we say, listen, I want you to take 30 days, 90 days, 6 months, whatever it takes, and make a commitment of purity. And I'm telling you, if you can't commit before the marriage, you're not going to commit after the marriage. If you can't be faithful before the marriage, you're not going to be faithful after the marriage. If you can't make a commitment to God to stay pure before you're married, you're not going to make a commitment to God to stay faithful to a wife after you're married. This is important. And there was a couple about 2 years ago that came and started counseling them, and their wedding was 6 months off. And I challenged them with this. I said, listen, they're here today. I'm not going to embarrass them or single them out, but they're here this morning. I challenged them and I said, I want you to stay pure for 6 months. And they said, well, we've already blown it. We've already made mistakes. What's the big deal? Let me tell you, if you're sleeping together, your honeymoon is just another night. There's nothing special to it. And more than that, it's a spiritual principle. You may have blown it, but God can restore your purity if you make a commitment of purity. And they did it, and they have not stopped thanking me since. That's one of the greatest things they had in their marriage, was staying pure. Those 6 months has really made a difference and brought God's blessing in a new way on them. We are raising the bar of morality on here. Tuesday night, Amanda went with all the teenage girls. I met with all the teenage boys, and we shared our story. I shared my mistakes. I shared the issues and the struggles. I'm not teaching this series because I did everything right, because I did everything wrong. And I want so much better for the children of our church, so much better for the teenagers of our church, than to have to pay the price I had to pay to get my marriage where it is today. Because we should not be married today. We should have been the statistic, not the standard. I mean, we were on the devil's playlist. We did everything wrong. We spent 5 years and just, it felt like hell. And when we first got married, because we had no relationship, it was just, we had addictions and bad. I had all sorts of issues from my past that I brought into the marriage that I should have destroyed my marriage. And it wasn't except for the grace of God that we're here today. So we want so much better. And number three, lasting love is protective. Lasting love is protective. It's protective. I'm working hard right now to protect you. I know some of you are looking at me as old-fashioned, as antiquated, but I am working hard for you right now in prayer. I feel the weight of this series like never before, like you're my own kids, and I'm fighting to get you to buy into God's ways. God wants to bless you. He wants to protect you. He wants to give you the most beautiful gift you could ever imagine, but you got to buy into his ways. Because lasting love, I have a protective relationship with my wife. I tell her my struggles. I tell her my, you say, what do you mean you tell her what you struggle with? Yes, I tell her what I struggle with because she's got skin in the game. There's no one more motivated to keep me accountable and to keep me pure than my wife. So I tell her, and men, I'm telling you, you'll never get over an addiction until you're honest with your wife. Women, you'll never get over an addiction until you're honest with your husband. God gave us marriage to help sanctify us and purify us. You're not going to beat it through prayer. You're going to beat it through confession. And that is the truth. So I've got rules in my marriage for purity to protect us. I go to bed when my wife goes to bed. It's not always convenient. It's not always fun. But the statistics are men who stay up later than their wife get in trouble on the internet, get in trouble on television. So I go to bed. There's no work I have to do more important than my marriage. So I go to bed when she goes to bed. I don't stay up later at night working because that's the time most people get in trouble. And I'm just not going to do it. I've got filters on all my computers. Everything I look at on the computer is emailed to my wife. She looks at everything I look at on the computer. It motivates me to make sure I'm living right. You know, it emails, I have a pastor friend who keeps me accountable. It emails him, it emails my wife. Get a filter on your computer, man. Whatever you need to do to protect your marriage. Lasting love is protective. I'm never alone with a woman. Yesterday, we had prayer meeting here in this building. I was here early setting up. One of the women showed up for the prayer meeting, and I asked her nicely, can you wait outside until everybody else shows up? Because I'm not going to be in a building alone, in a car alone, in an office alone. I'm not going to be anywhere alone with a woman. I have an obligation to protect my marriage, to protect my ministry, to protect this church. Purity. Purity. Let's move on to the last point, verse 10. This is how she responds. How will we know when she's ready? This is what she says. I am a wall and my breasts are like towers. Now, she's not bragging here. She's saying they're out of reach. You just not just anybody can touch these. These are protected. They are towers. They are out of reach. I protected myself. Thus, because I had standards, because I didn't treat my body as cheap, I have become in his eyes like one bringing contentment. And this is a play on words in Hebrew, because this word contentment in the Hebrew is the Hebrew word shalom, which means peace, which also we learned in this series that Solomon in Hebrew is shalom, which also is the Hebrew word shalom, which means peace. That's why she is called the Shulamite, which is the feminine version of Solomon, who is shalom. And so here it is. It's a play on words. She is one who brings him peace. And let me just say, number four, lasting love is peaceful. When you've done it God's way, when you're living by God's standard, there is great peace in your relationship. There's great security. There's just this. And I know some of you right now are saying it's too late for me. I've blown it. I've made mistakes. I've done things that have damaged my marriage. Remember the rules. Start today. Apply God's standards today. Forget those things which are behind. Start applying God's standard today. Make a decision today. Single people, make a decision to live pure. You may have made mistakes yet. Start fresh today. Make a decision to be pure. Just tell them you can touch it if you put a ring on it. I mean, just be honest. Just make a decision to be pure if you really want to find a love that's lasting. And let's finish off this book. I love the last couple verses of this chapter in this book. Solomon had a vineyard in Baal Hamon. Remember in chapter 1, she was working in a vineyard? Well, it was Solomon's vineyard. It was Solomon's vineyard. It was his vineyard. And the workers in the vineyard were her brothers. That was her brothers. He let out his vineyard to tenants. Those were her brothers. Each was to bring for its fruit 1,000 shekels of silver. But my own vineyard is now mine to give. Remember in chapter 1, she said, I've been working on other people's vineyards, so I've neglected my own. Well, now her vineyard has been protected. It's been preserved. It's pure. And her vineyard is now hers to give. What she's saying, if I did not submit to my brothers, I would have never met Solomon. Remember, she was complaining and griping because she thought they were harsh and she thought they were mean, and they were putting demands on her and standards on her she didn't want to live by. Well, now we realize if she didn't listen and submit and obey her brothers, she would have never married the king. She would have never met Solomon. And so she says, the 1,000 shekels are for you, Solomon, and 200 are for those who tend its fruit. What she's saying there, the 200 were for her brothers. What she's literally saying is thank you to her brothers. She's saying, I was angry at you. I was mad at you. I thought you were being mean and harsh, but you protected me. You protected me for my future. Thank you. Thank you for protecting me. Thank you for doing that for me. And let me ask you, single people, who do you have in your life that you trust that you've given the right to say no to your relationship to? Because you should not be in any relationships as a single person without somebody outside of you helping you make a decision. Because man, when you're in love, your emotions are all over the map. You need somebody godly, somebody that loves you, somebody that wants to protect you, to be able to say that relationship is wrong or it's the wrong time and you need to obey and listen or you're not going to have the blessing of God. That's not your decision to make by yourself. That's the world's way. The world teaches you it's my life, it's my body, I can do what I want. That's not God's way for you. God's way is that you need people to help you. You need people to speak into your relationships and say, that relationship is wrong or that is the wrong time. It's not right. And you be willing to say, you know what? I'll trust you and I'll break it off and I'll stop it and I'll postpone it. I'll do whatever I need to do. That's God's standard. Verse 13. He kind of teases. Solomon says, you who dwell in the gardens with friends and attendants, let me hear your voice. He's basically saying, I'm working and I'm thinking about her. I'm thinking about her. Man, let me give you a great piece of advice. Tomorrow when you're at work, just send her a text and say, you know what? I'm thinking about you. I'm at work and I'm just thinking about you. You're the greatest thing in my life. You're the biggest blessing God's ever given. And when she finally gets off the floor after reading your text, she'll probably respond like this. This is what I love. Here's verse 14, the last verse of this book. And again, remember, this is their senior years. They're not young anymore. You know, this is not, you know, the youngins. This is their senior lives. Verse 14, she says, come away, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or like a young stag on the spice-laden mountains. Now, we told you what those mountains were in chapter 4. You can put it together on your own. We know exactly what she's saying. She's saying, hurry home. I want you now. Come, be like a stag. Remember in the beginning, she says, my lover is like a young stag. Here she is in the senior years of her life, still looking at him as that young stag. Hurry home, my lover. I'm telling you, God's way works. God's way works. I have another pastor friend that travels a lot, and he told me this story that every time he goes on a trip, his wife hides little notes in his suitcase and his clothes. And so every day he puts on a different outfit and he finds notes, and he won't tell me what's in the notes, but you can only imagine. And he says, needless to say, every trip he's on, he'll get these notes in his shirt pocket, a jacket pocket, pants pocket. And every single trip he's been on, he said, he calls his secretary, he said, you got to find a way to get me home now. I can't take it anymore. I mean, call the airline, cancel my meeting. I'm coming home now. Because she's saying, hurry home, young stag. Hurry home, my lover. And I love it that God's way is passionate. God's way works. God wants you to be passionate until your dying days. That's God's stance. See, Satan wants you to live in the most boring sex life ever imaginable after you're married. That's what Satan wants you. That's his plan for you. God wants it to be passionate, but you got to do it God's way. You got to live by his standards. So let me give you two takeaways as we close today. Great relationships are no accident. You're not going to have a great marriage by accident. It's going to be on purpose. And you're going to have to make some tough decisions. And today in our culture, we are trained to follow our feelings. It's my feelings. It's what I want. That's what we're trained. And I'm telling you today, choices lead, feelings follow. You don't fall in love. You'll fall out of love as easily as you fall into love. You choose to love somebody. And the first takeaway is love is a choice. Love is a choice. And the greatest expression of love is when I don't feel like it. See, that's the greatest expression. It doesn't take great love when you feel like it. It takes great love when you don't feel like to express it. A couple months ago, my son woke up in the middle of the night throwing up all over himself. I didn't feel like getting up in the middle of the night and cleaning him off and changing his clothes and taking out the sheets. I didn't feel like doing that, but I did it because I love him. I did it because I love him. Colossians 3 says, and over all these virtues, put on love. See, love is something you put on. It's not something you fall into. It's a choice you make. It's a decision you make. And I don't want to be naive here today and try to make this sound a lot easier than it really is. Because I know it's really easy to listen to a message and say, wow, that sounds good, Pastor. It's like a brochure to Hawaii, but I've never been there. You know, I mean, it's just not as easy. this isn't easy. I don't want to communicate that this is easy, because it's not. This is tough. If you want to put on the choice of love, it's tough. It's tough to put on love. It's tough to love when you don't feel like it. It's tough to commit when things are falling apart. It's not easy. It is tough. But let me give you the secret. You can have everything I've described this entire series if you'll just understand one key secret. And it's the very reason God allowed his son to die. Jesus allowed himself to be tortured and killed and beaten and ripped apart so badly that they couldn't even recognize him as a human being. He just looked like a bloody piece of meat. For one reason. And you've heard me say it time and time again. God does not want to be your religion. He wants to be your dad. He's building a family and he wants you to be a part of it. And you'll never be able to accomplish any of this without first receiving God's love in your life. So the second takeaway is being loved gives the capacity to love. 1 John 4 says, we love because he first loved us. We love, why? Because he first loved us. If God doesn't fill you with his love, if you don't receive God's love, you'll never be able to love others. You'll never be able to make a commitment and truly honor that commitment. Never be able to love somebody when it doesn't feel good if you don't first allow yourself to be filled up. Your love bank needs to be full if you want to give out. And the only way for it to be full is for you to receive God's love. We love because he first loved us. That's the only way to do it. Is you got to take his love. You got to receive his love. Your human love will fail. Your human love will fall. Your human love will walk away. God's love is perfect. And if you take his love into your life, then you have something truly great to offer your family, your children, your husband, your wife. But it starts with him. And so as we close today, I'm going to give anybody here a chance that needs to make that first decision to have a relationship with God. God's not the priority of your life. And what salvation is when you reprioritize your life around God, where you make a decision, God's going to be number one in my life. Because I'll be very, very honest. If God's not at the top of your list, he's not on your list. Don't fool yourself. God's not just something you fit into your life. He's either at the top of your list or he's not on your list. Church may be on your list, but I'm telling you, God's not on your list if he ain't at the top. And what salvation is you reorder your life to reflect God's number one. God's number one in every area of my life. He's number one in my family. He's number one in my marriage. He's number one in my career, my business. He's number one in my finances. He's number one. And that's what salvation is. And so I want to ask anyone here today that needs to make that decision to reprioritize your life and make God number one, or to recommit yourself today. Because you could say, you know what? There was a point in my life where I really felt God was number one, but I just don't feel that anymore. He's just not at number one right now. And I want to make a new decision today. So would you close your eyes with me and just bow your heads for a moment? I'm going to say a very simple prayer. I'm not going to ask you to stand up or come forward or single you out or embarrass you in any way. I just want to say a very simple prayer with you. It's a prayer you can say in your heart. God can hear your heart. But if you need to join me in that prayer today to reorder your life, to reflect God's number one, would you just raise your hand right now and nobody looking around? Just raise your hand right now. Thank you. Is there anybody else? Thank you. Is there anybody else? Thank you. Is there anybody else? Thank you. Thank you. The prayer is simple. I want you to just say this to yourself in your own words. First off, say, God, I invite you into my life. I want your love. And I want to make you number one. So just give God an invitation into your life in your own words. The second part of that prayer is just ask him for forgiveness. We've all blown it. I am the biggest sinner here. I mean, I have so much in my past that I'm absolutely ashamed of. And it's just the grace of God that I stand here today. We've all had to take a step and ask for forgiveness. So would you just say, God, forgive me. And then the last part of that prayer is just say thank you. Would you just say thank you for what God did for you, that he allowed his son Jesus to be crucified on your behalf, to pay a price you couldn't pay. Just express your gratefulness right now to God. Now, if you made that commitment for the very first time, you can look up, or you renewed that commitment today. On your connection card, there's two boxes. One says, I'm making a commitment to Christ. One says, I'm renewing my commitment. If you made either decision, I would challenge you and encourage you to take one more step on your own. Check off one of those boxes, drop it off in one of the tithe and offering boxes so that we can come alongside of you and support you in the decision you made. You're not going to, if you don't communicate that decision and bring in a family to help you with that decision, you're not going to walk it out very far. You need help, and we want to support you and help you with it. There's also books outside that say, now what? Many times you make that decision to put God at number one. The natural question is, now what? This book will answer that question. As well as that, if you don't have a hard copy of the Bible, please take one today. It would be our greatest honor to give you a Bible as a gift. This is the greatest book you'll ever read. It's not just ink on pages, but it is actually alive. We have a church reading plan. There's bookmarks outside where you can join us. We're reading through the Bible this year as a church. If I could ask you to do one thing as a pastor, it would be read the Bible daily with us. It'll change your life. It's the number one thing we do as a church family is we get into God's Word every day. You could read Song of Solomon. We finished it this week. 8 chapters. It's a great book to read to recap this series. So please pick up a Bible if you don't have one. Stand with me as we close today. Father, in the name of Jesus Christ, I just pray a blessing over every person here. God, I thank you for the men that are here today on Father's Day that are saying, you are first in my life. And even though it's Father's Day, I want my family and children to know that you are the priority of my life. And God, take this series and just reorder our life, reorder our heart, reorder our thinking, God, to your way of doing things, because your way works and your way brings blessing. And you didn't give us these standards to be mean and to punish us and take pleasure out of our life, but you gave us these standards to protect us and to bless us and to sustain our pleasure so that we could have godly pleasure that lasts a lifetime and not a short run of sinful pleasure that leaves us sick and guilty and condemned. So let us to buy into your way of doing things, which will protect us and bless us and be the greatest gift. It's not a legalistic thing, God. It's a love letter that you wrote to show us how to do it right so that we can live lives that are fruitful in every area. And we thank you for this great book that you've given us to teach us about marriage, about dating, about sex, to see your heart and passion for that area of our life. In the name of Jesus, amen. Happy Father's Day and have a wonderful week.